The first oral argument today will be presented partially in person, partially via Zoom. This is United States v. Logan, and we'll hear first from the appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court, Kayla Gassman for the appellant Corey Logan. This case involves the warrantless search of a home where Fourth Amendment protection is at its highest. The mushroom grow evidence found during the warrantless search of Mr. Logan's home should have been suppressed. The emergency aid exception did not apply to the officer's entry, re-entry, and search of Mr. Logan's home, where they had no facts suggesting that anyone was present in the home, either a dangerous person or any potential additional victim who could have been in need of aid. The possibility or the absence of information about whether someone is present does not justify the search of a home. The district court also erred in the alternative by applying the inevitable discovery exception to the exclusionary rule, where the government wholly failed to establish the chain of events that would have led inevitably to the discovery of the evidence. I want to address both of those points in turn today. First, the entry. So Mr. Logan was shot in the doorway of his trailer home by someone in the yard outside. Officers and medical personnel responded to get him emergency medical assistance while he was still inside the home. But to search beyond what was necessary to get Mr. Logan that aid, the officers needed facts suggesting that there was an additional person in the rest of the home, either the shooter or another dangerous person posing a danger, or an additional victim who could have been in need of aid. I don't think there's really any dispute that the officers did not see or hear any signs that there was anyone else present in the home. Instead, the government and the district court both rely on the possibility that somebody could have been in the rest of the home, or the absence of information about whether there was someone in the closed bedroom in the rest of the home.
Well, counsel, can I just stop you there? How does that cut? They didn't know, but perhaps they were worried that someone was in there. How does that cut?
This court's case law is very clear. So Martinez, Nelson, Bagley are all clear that the absence of information about whether someone is present doesn't justify the search of the home. So if they don't have facts suggesting that there's someone present, then they cannot search the rest of the home.
And of course, Nelson and Bagley involve the Bowie exception, not exigent circumstances, correct?
Correct. The government does try to invoke Bowie, and they do try to invoke the possibility that the shooter could have been inside the home, so that there could have been a dangerous person inside the home as one of the exigent circumstances. The district court rejected that, said the shooter was outside the home, the officers knew that. There's no reason to believe that the shooter could have run inside the home without Mr. Logan or his girlfriend who called 911, Samantha Case, without either of them noticing. And here, I think it's important why the absence of information means that they can't search the rest of the home is particularly applicable here, where the officers, they did have information. They did immediately make contact with the victim, Mr. Logan. They immediately made contact with Samantha Case, the caller. So they knew that the shooter was outside the home. So it's not the absence of information entirely. They knew quite a lot about where the shooter had been, that the incident had happened at the front door with the shooter in the yard. Neither Mr. Logan nor Samantha mentioned anything about another person. The officers were inside the home while Mr. Logan got attention from the paramedics. They didn't hear or see anything that indicated there was another person.
What the district court, Judge Melbourne, found, rejected the idea, as you said, that the shooter might have been in the home. But the district court did find that they had reasonable belief that there might be just other third parties, other individuals in the home.
So
and it relied on, as I recall, it relied on the fact that there had been, the focus of the shooting seemed to be that north bedroom, and there were some bullet holes and that sort of thing in the doorway, and that perhaps that might lead to the conclusion that there was someone else in there?
So the district court did said in the order that they could have believed there was someone in that bedroom, but didn't rely on any facts suggesting that there actually was someone in there. That was based on, again, the absence of information about whether there was anyone in that room, and the absence of information doesn't justify the search of that room.
So that was clearly erroneous finding?
I debated with myself, is that a factual conclusion? Is it a legal conclusion? I think either way it's baseless because it's based on the absence of information.
Whether it's a reasonable belief is a legal conclusion.
Right, and there were some bullet bullet holes in the door. I don't think there's anything supporting that, like, the focus, like, the target of the shooting was that bedroom. It was clear Mr. Logan was shot in the doorway, and just the setup of the trailer homes, it basically seems like some stray bullets, like, hit the door of that bedroom. But again, the officers had been inside the home for several minutes, while several officers, while Mr. Logan got medical attention, and they didn't hear or see anything from that room. And Ms. Case told the officers that only Mr. Logan lived there. When she was asked, she said that only she and Mr. Logan had been there that night. So there just were no facts suggesting that there was anyone else in that bedroom. And the officers needed something indicating that there was someone there to be able to search. The government did also, in addition to Bowie, the government raises this issue that maybe Samantha Case's 911 call also contains some element of consent to investigate the shooting. That is, it's not supported by the record. First, I think it's a highly fact-intensive issue whether she had authority to give consent, and they didn't, the government would have the burden on that. They didn't raise it that in the district court at all. So first,
I'm sorry. So we have no district court finding on that particular question.
Correct. The government didn't even raise that argument to the district court that her call gave consent to the officers to investigate the shooting. That was raised for the first time on appeal. So there's no factual finding on that. And the facts that are in the record just completely contradict that, where she told the officers multiple times that she did not live in the trailer. And they, the officers on the scene asked her if she lived there. She said no. And the officers then recognized that she then did not have authority to give them consent to investigate the shooting and search the rest of the house. So they continued to look for ways to do that. So then they asked Mr. Logan for consent. He also said no. So that argument about her consent is really just, it was waived in the district court, and it's contradicted by the record that we do have, because she did clearly did not have authority to give consent to the officers to search the house. Do you want to move on to inevitable discovery? I think that the district court was wrong to apply the inevitable discovery exception. Here, I think our argument here rests on what I think is not a remarkable proposition, that when the government has the burden of proof, the government needs to establish the facts that support an issue.
On the other hand, let me ask you about the standard. Now, you've questioned using the standard that, of course, your office objects to, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the ruling or to the government, arguing that, well, there's no specific cases dealing with the application of that standard to inevitable discovery doctrine, but we have dozens and dozens and dozens, maybe even hundreds of published opinions that say when we review the denial of a motion to suppress, we view the evidence in the light most favorable to ruling or to the government. So how can we, as a panel, disregard applying those cases? I obviously recognize that you're arguing that we should revisit that under Ornelas and Bob, but obviously we as a panel can't do that. So aren't we required, since this is the denial of a motion to suppress, to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the government in appraising the inevitable discovery doctrine?
So a couple of responses to that. So first, I think we, you know, I did point out we just didn't find cases on inevitable discovery that discussed the light most favorable standard. So since our position is that that standard isn't supported by the Supreme Court case law, understanding it is the 10th Circuit standard, I would just suggest the court not extend that error to also apply it in the inevitable discovery context. But my second response to that is, I don't think that standard ever carries with it, like, filling in the gaps where the government just didn't present evidence. And I think that's what would be required in this case, because what the government presented was that the officers would have had probable cause to search for evidence of the shooting, and that an officer testified that they would ultimately have sought a warrant anyway to investigate the shooting, even absent the initial illegal search. But that's not enough.
And that they did obtain the warrant.
They did obtain the warrant, but the government, what the government.
Is that a factor?
It is, but what the government didn't do, the government also has to establish what the chain of events would have been that would have led to the discovery of the evidence, like, in the same place. And they just utterly failed to put on evidence of that. What they introduced was probable cause, and the officer said that they would have got a warrant anyway. Now, the government says that we didn't preserve this issue, but it's the government's burden of proof. So the government needed to prove up inevitability. They needed to prove up what the chain of events would have been, how the scene would have been secured, what the timeline would have been of the investigation absent the illegal search, whatever other facts are necessary to show an actual inevitable chain of events. And they just didn't do that.
Well, let me probe that. Now, you say that they didn't have any evidence about that, but what we do know is that the officers continued to stay on the property after the ambulance left. And there was one officer that was standing over shell casing and saying not only was it his job to do that, to preserve the scene, but it is standard protocol for this police department to secure the scene. We have evidence, at least for some period of that 4.5 hour gap, that officers did remain on site after they left the house. We know that the officers said that they would have obtained a warrant, and we have a factual finding that the police department would have sought and obtained a warrant. And so, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, if we reject your previous argument about the expansion or the application of that standard, aren't we required to reasonably infer that the officers would have continued to secure the scene? After all, I mean, we can't apply common sense. This is an attempted murder. And so isn't it a little bit unrealistic to assume that the officers would have simply abandoned the scene when there is evidence of an attempted murder?
So there are two things in what you said that I think are very important. One is that there's evidence officers stayed on the scene for some period of time. We don't know for how long. All of the evidence was about the immediate aftermath of the shooting and when Mr. Logan was taken away in the ambulance. There's multiple hours after that where there's no evidence whatsoever. I think the other important part of what you said is, and then I want to reserve time for rebuttal, is that we can apply common sense. I think even viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the government doesn't mean that you fill in the gaps. The government's brief is also full of what you would expect, what the common sense would be, what you would probably be done in a shooting investigation. I don't think that's enough. I think when the government bears the burden of proof, even if it's a question that seems very obvious, it would be very easy for them to establish. For example, the FDI insurance in a bank robbery case, interstate commerce, that a gun traveled in interstate commerce in a felon in possession case. These things are very easy facts to establish, but the government still has to establish them. And I don't think viewing the light and the evidence in the light most favorable to the government means you fill in the gaps where they just didn't present the evidence. So I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thanks.
Court recognizes Mr. Glazer.
Good morning, Mr. Court. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
The officers acted reasonably in conducting a brief sweep of Mr. Logan's home in this case, and in any event, the district court did not commit any plain error in concluding that officers would inevitably discover the mushroom operation pursuant to a valid warrant. I'd like to briefly start with the Fourth Amendment, the substantive Fourth Amendment issue, although I do think inevitable discovery is perhaps an easier way for the court to resolve this case. The ultimate touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness, and the officers in this case acted reasonably in conducting a brief sweep approximately 12 minutes after a 911 call reporting a shooting. They arrived upon the scene and discovered someone who was a victim of the shooting and saw bullet holes traveling through a room that, at the time of the sweep, they had not yet entered. This court should not impose artificial limits on what officers may do when they arrive at the scene of a recent shooting. Certainly, the Fourth Amendment protects the home, but in this case, the officers acted reasonably after they had entered the home in order to render emergency aid to Mr. Logan in re-entering to ensure that there was no one within the home also in need of emergency aid and to ensure their own safety.
Counsel, why would the officers have ever, if they reasonably believed there was some third party in this home, somewhere in the home, that they were unaware of, why would they have all, and they did all, leave the home? When Mr. Logan was taken out to the ambulance, every single one of them were outside. That doesn't strike me as the actions of officers that think there's somebody still inside that home.
Remember, I think it's important to remember this was a fluid situation, and if you watch the video from the officers' body cameras, you can see that the additional officers beyond Officer McKenna initially entered the building in an attempt to get out information about who might have been the perpetrator in the shooting. They were asking Officer McKenna if he'd gotten any information from Mr. Logan. It's true that they did leave They did all leave the building before the sweep. But again, it was a very fluid situation. The sergeant arrived on the scene, and one of the officers said we swept the house, and he said, no, let's do it.
Well, that's not quite accurate. A lot of things happened before that. For instance, I think from the testimony, Officer Rogers specifically was asked whether he had a conversation with Sergeant Kimball regarding before the sweep of the residence, and he said yes. And that conversation was about whether there was anyone else inside. He said no, there shouldn't be. And he said that conversation with the supervising officer, Officer Kimball, who eventually orders the sweep. He said, no, there shouldn't be anyone. And then after that, the sweep gets ordered. We also have the officer that arrives on the scene telling them, dispatch, it's all clear. The other officers can come in. Is that normal if they expect there's other people in the house that they're not aware of?
Your Honor, I don't think we certainly don't believe from the record that officers expected other people to be in the house.
Right, so that's not enough. That's not enough under our case law. Just to, if they have no other information that someone's in the house and they just think that someone might be, that's just not sufficient. I don't understand what else we have here.
Your Honor, I think there are a few other things, and I agree that our argument on this is made more challenging by Nelson and Martinez, who say that simply having no information one way or the other is not sufficient. But again, the Fourth Amendment is based on reasonableness, and here there are a few other factors that contribute to the reasonableness of officers' reentry. One of them, and I understand opposing counsel says that we failed to raise it below, but one of those things is the fact that they were invited into the home to render emergency aid, yes, but officers could also reasonably believe that was an invitation to try to identify the shooter in this case.
Okay, I'm sorry, Mr. Glazer, and maybe I misunderstood, but I think Judge Morris is asking you about exigent circumstances, not about implied consent.
Correct.
So let's stick to that. Let's stick to her question for the time being.
So, Your Honor, I think if you were relying solely on exigent circumstances with no other doctrines involved, it would be very difficult to distinguish this case from Nelson and Martinez. I do think there are some distinctions, including the fact that the officers had already been invited into the house. And so I think that plays into the exigency in this case, in that if they didn't simply enter, in the case of Martinez, for example, an abandoned building that happened to have bullet holes in it.
Explain that to me, if you would, Mr. Glazer. I'm not trying to quibble with you, but I would think that would be your adversary's principal argument. Samantha Case specifically asked the officers to come in to attend to one individual, Mr. Logan. So, and then they left after Mr. Logan was transported by the EMT. So how does Samantha Case's invitation to the officers to attend to this one individual suggest that there were other individuals in the house?
Your Honor, it does not suggest that there were other individuals in the house. I'm not making that argument. Rather, I think the significance is that the officers could act here in pursuit of their own and possible victims' safety. The Supreme Court has established that is permissible if they have an objectively reasonable basis for believing that someone is inside. And the fact that she had invited them in, and the fact that there was a recent shooting here, that confirmed that it was a recent shooting, it wasn't like Martinez, whether it wasn't clear whether there were victims inside the house. All of the facts together, in the government's view, indicate that the officers acted reasonably here. It was the middle of the night. They come to a scene of a recent shooting, and they could reasonably believe that it was in pursuit of their own safety and possible victim safety to enter that room. I certainly agree that this argument is challenging in light of Nelson and Martinez. However, Nelson and Martinez didn't confront the type of situation here where there was a confirmed recent shooting, and the officers had been recently in the home and were still outside the home. In fact, Mr. Logan had not yet been transported from the scene at the time of the sweep. So in the government's view, the officers acted reasonably here in pursuit of their own and potential victims' safety by conducting this brief sweep. It's the sort of sweep that the Supreme Court said in the Minsey case was permissible after when officers arrived upon a murder scene, a brief sweep to look for victims or the possible killer. And we're not saying that officers can arrive upon any crime scene and conduct a sweep of the house, But under the facts of this case, with bullet holes and travel through that room, the officers acted reasonably in attempting to ascertain whether someone was in that room.
Not to beat a dead horse, but you mentioned the bullet holes through that room. And so I have two-fold questions. One is, are you at least a little bit extending what the record actually shows? I understood that the evidence was that there were bullet holes between the doorway to the right of facing the house to the doorway toward the north bedroom. But I never understood that there was any evidence. Frankly, I didn't even see any argument in your brief that the bullet holes were actually targeting and hit the wall, the exterior wall of the north bedroom.
Your Honor, I think, actually, if you look at the record, the supplemental record on appeal has the exhibits from the evidentiary hearing, and it does appear from the record that at least one bullet traveled through the exterior wall for a short distance, perhaps, I don't know, 18 to 24 inches through that bedroom, and then came out through the interior door through that bedroom. So there is indication that at least one, if not additional bullets, passed through that bedroom. It was for a short period, obviously, because they were coming in an angle. But I think if you look at the record, it does actually bear that out.
Can I, not to monopolize your time, but I have a second related question, and that is that now your adversary says that, well, of course it was, you know, the man or woman missed, and Mr. Logan is standing outside the doorway. One of the difficulties that I have in a lot of these cases is there's no visual aid showing this house, and it seems, or a trailer, and so it seems to be a very small residence. And so if the person misses by a few inches, Mr. Logan, and misses to the right, well, then the bullets are going to either hit the exterior wall facing the north bedroom or be toward the north bedroom. But how would that reasonably suggest to the officers that there was someone in the north bedroom? We know that the shooter was targeting Mr. Logan, and we know where Mr. Logan was standing. He was standing outside the doorway. He opened the door. So how did the bullet holes on the right suggest that there were other third parties inside the house?
Your Honor, first of all, I don't think we know from the record that he was standing outside the door. We know he came to the door. And I think it's reasonable to believe he was actually inside the door because the number of bullet holes when he was struck, because the number of bullet holes through the wall correspond to the number of shell casings. And secondly, we don't say that bullets simply passing through that room indicates that someone was there, but rather that in all the circumstances, the officers could reasonably enter that room to ensure that no one was there. And with my remaining comment, I'd like to turn to the inevitable discovery, which I think is certainly a government's stronger argument. And I think it's important here, first of all, to address the plain error standard of review. So Mr. Logan argues that plain error should not apply because the government bore the burden of establishing inevitable discovery. But there are many instances in which the government bears the burden of something, and that doesn't prevent the other party from forfeiting that argument on appeal. So, for example, in a jury trial, the government bears the burden of establishing proof beyond reasonable doubt, and the defendant does not have to file a motion for judgment of acquittal. But if he wants to make arguments on appeal, he has to file that motion for judgment of acquittal. And what we have here is Mr. Logan making an argument that there wasn't sufficient proof that the officers remained on the scene. He's making an argument that he did not make in the district court. Once the government made the argument in his response to his motion to suppress, he had an opportunity to raise that argument in his
Counsel, as I recall the briefing of this case, you of course raised the inevitable discovery issue in response to the motion. It was just a couple of paragraphs. There wasn't any specifics. And then you had the burden at the hearing to present evidence of, in particular, the first Sousa factor, which was the extent to which the warrant process had been completed. That was the government's burden. And I would like for you to very specifically tell me, and I don't mean with just general common sense suggestions, how the government met its burden of proof as to that first factor.
Your Honor, the warrant process had not yet begun at the time of the sweep. So
right.
We're not relying on the first Sousa factor, but this court has said it's not as possible.
But we've said the first Sousa factor, in some cases we actually said the first Sousa factor was a prerequisite. We've since backed off of that a little bit, but we continue to say that it is an extremely important factor. So how do you get there in this case with zero evidence of anything, even in particular the evidence that you mentioned in the brief where you say that you proved that they were they stationed officers at the house? I didn't see that in the record.
Your Honor, maybe I'm misunderstanding your question, but the first Sousa factor is the extent of the warrant process.
Right, I'm moving on now really to the other factors,
okay.
but talk to me about that.
Sure. So, Your Honor, I think the strongest evidence that we proved circumstantially that the officers did secure the scene is that there was testimony that there were officers on the scene after Mr. Logan had arrived at the hospital and was being transported to the emergency room. Officer McKenna testified to that effect. We don't know exactly what time period that was.
Right.
Secondly, we have evidence in the record, testimony that there was an officer standing over the shelter scene. There was testimony
Can you be specific about that?
The evidence.
Can you be specific about that? What testimony was there about an officer standing over the evidence, and at what point was that?
Your Honor, this is on page 58 of volume 3 of the record, and I'm not recalling off the top of my head. I believe it was Officer Carter who testified that he talked to that officer. You can also see on the body cam footage him talking to the officer who says he has 5 shell casings there. So that was from, I believe, Officer Rogers.
And this is while they're all milling around and they're outside and they're right. So this is at the beginning. What evidence is there that you protected the scene all the way up to the point of the warrant?
Your Honor, the officer testified that it was standard procedure to stand over the bullet casings and preserve the evidence. And then we have
that doesn't get you there. That doesn't meet your burden, though, does it? An officer could always say, "Well, it would be standard procedure for us to secure the home." It would be standard procedure. If that's all you got to do, you don't have to put an officer on to say, "I did stand there. I was there for 4 hours." You can just say it was It would have been standard procedure. That would meet your burden here.
If I may answer, I see my time's expired. Your Honor, if the defendant had raised the argument,
why does the defendant have to raise it? Why does the defendant have to raise it when it was your burden to prove the various factors? And you didn't put that evidence on. What was the defendant's burden at that point? I guess I'm not following you on that.
Your Honor, in the district court, the defendant did not bear a burden. But in order to raise that error on appeal, he had to raise it below. But the government could have easily, asked an officer, did officers remain on the scene? I think everyone just assumed it because it was pretty obvious from the context. And I would like, if I may, point to one other factor, and that is as we point out in our brief, the photograph of the scene afterward, in daylight hours, shows those shell casings with markers next to them. And so, based on the officer's testimony about standard procedure and those pictures together, coupled with common sense, although I recognize that was not part of this question, indicates that the government met its burden here. And at the very least, Mr. Logan cannot show a plain error in the district court concluding that discovery was inevitable.
Though we're out of time, I think it is important to get all of our questions answered. So I do have one follow-up to Judge Moritz's question, and I'll give the appellant an additional minute for rebuttal, by the way. I have a question about not only your answer, but also this argument in the brief, and I don't mean that critically at all. Well argued. But Officer Carson was standing over the shell casings. The testimony, as I think you alluded to, and I think I recall that in the record, is that the protocol of the police department was to preserve the evidence. What I don't understand is the implication that Officer Carson or someone else from the police department is just going to stand over that shell casing for the rest of his natural life. At some point, the police department, I assume, I've never been a police officer, but I assume that they're going to photograph the scene and we're going to have pictures of the record on appeal, as we frequently do, and we'll have testimony from Officer Carson testifying to the chain of custody and to verify and to authenticate that photograph that that was a true scene. But what I don't understand is how the protocol that he followed in standing over the shell casing in order to preserve the evidence would suggest that he was going to stand over that shell casing for the next 4.5 hours. And that, I think, is the question that your adversary is presenting.
So, Your Honor, first, just to clarify, Officer Carson was not the one who stood over the shell casings. That was an officer whose name wasn't actually included in the record, and he wasn't called at the evidentiary hearing. It was a different officer. I think it's a logical inference to conclude that when an officer testifies that the protocol is to stand over evidence to preserve it, evidence is outside the home, and the scene was, as we know from the record, processed at a subsequent time in the daylight hours with those photographs taken. It's a reasonable inference to conclude, and the district court committed no clear error in concluding, or plain error in concluding, that the officers took some measures to continue to secure that scene for about those 4.5 hours.
Thank you. Judge Morris, do you have any questions? All right, thank you for indulging us with our additional questions. We'll hear from the appellant for rebuttal, and as I indicated, we'll give the appellant an additional minute.
Well, I feel a little hamstrung because I think you made my rebuttal for me in your questioning.
Well, I was just intending to ask questions. I wasn't intending to advocate.
So you have already, Judge Bacharach pointed out, I think, the gaps in the government's evidence. They want to talk about the officer standing over the shell casings, but like you've said and I've said, our brief said, there's no testimony about how long he would have done that. Was he going to stand there for 6 hours? I don't know. The record doesn't say, and the government didn't put in evidence of that. They talk about the photographs the next morning, but there's no testimony in the record about when those were taken, who took those, no evidence about the timing of those, so those also don't fill the gaps. They talk about the officers saying that there were still testifying that there were officers on the scene when he went to the hospital with Mr. Logan. But again, no testimony at all about the timing. So there's hours long gaps with no evidence from the government about what was happening on the scene or how that scene would have been secured or what the timeline of the investigation would have been.
Was it your obligation to raise that?
I do want to briefly address preservation. The government says we didn't preserve this argument. I have several responses to that. First, as I said initially, we've already covered, it is the government's burden of proof. I don't see how we have an obligation to counter an argument that they never affirmatively made. Second, I think we did point out these gaps to the district court. I'll point the court specifically to where in the record we did alert the district court to the fact that the government needed to do more than it had done. The government was relying on probable cause, and the government was relying on the testimony that the officer would have sought a warrant anyway, and that's it. And we told the district, and even before the evidence was put on, which is the opportunity we had to brief this, in our reply brief at page 46 of volume 1, we told the district court that the government didn't establish the warrant process had already begun, and that the, quote, government makes no other effort to establish inevitability. So that's pointing out to the district court the government has not met its burden.
I know time doesn't matter, but you didn't point out the timing, your timing argument.
But the government, it's the government's obligation to establish the timing.
You did not say anything about failure to produce evidence regarding the 4 hours. That's my question.
That's true, but our only opportunity to do that would have been after the government actually did not put on the evidence. So in the briefing, of course, we couldn't know that the government wasn't going to put on evidence. So at the hearing, after the evidence had been put on, we did alert the court again to the fact at volume 3, page 95, that the government didn't discuss any details, they don't discuss any standard, and that they were asking the court to assume inevitable discovery, which is not sufficient. And we did also ask for the opportunity to do supplemental briefing after the evidence had been presented, specifically on inevitable discovery, and the district court denied us that opportunity. So that, I think, implicates this court's case law, that when a party doesn't have an opportunity to fully object to an issue, then this court reviews it as if it had been preserved. If again, I do think we adequately alerted the district court to the argument that the government hadn't done enough, that relying on probable cause and relying on the testimony that they would have sought a warrant wasn't enough. The government needed to establish more facts, needed to set forth more detail about how this truly would have been inevitable. But even if the court's not satisfied with that, we did ask the district court for the opportunity to say more and to do supplemental briefing, and the district court denied us that chance. We did preserve our inevitable discovery argument. I think the district court erred by approving the entry and also by applying inevitable discovery. So we would ask this court to reverse.
Do you have any questions? No, I'm good.
All right, thank you. This matter will be submitted.